All right, I'm going to call the Labor Committee to order, and I would entertain a motion to approve the minutes from February 19th.
I'll move the minutes on February 19th, Madam Chair.
Representative Eklund moves approval of the minutes from February 19th. Any discussion to the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Minutes from February 19th are approved. So first on the agenda is Representative Cantrell with House File 3433. And so we have House File 3433 before us, and I move that it be referred to the Committee on Government Operations. Representative Cantrell, welcome to the committee, and please present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I appreciate you having me before you today. House File 3433 is a bill that puts together a task force to evaluate a well-thought-out phase-out of the practice known as the subminimum wage. Currently, people with disabilities may be paid less than minimum wage by a 14C certified employer who has been authorized by the Department of Labor to pay wages below minimum wage to people with disabilities based on a subjective assessment of productivity. The subminimum wage was created in the 1938 Fair Labor Standard Act, whereby employers apply to the Department of Labor for a 14C waiver, which, if granted, allows the employers to pay people with disabilities less than minimum wage. The idea was that by virtue of being able to pay people with disabilities less than minimum wage, it would be a desirable incentive for businesses to hire more people with disabilities, especially considering the time during which this act was passed into law in the 1930s, when we in the United States were beginning to move away from the rampant and appalling widespread practice of the institutionalization of people with disabilities, and instead moving towards an approach that focused more on the full integration into society of folks with disabilities. However, as time has gone on, one-fifth of the U.S. population today is living with a disability, and only 18% of people with disabilities are currently employed in the non-sheltered workshop workforce. Sheltered workshops were initially conceived with the goal of helping people with disabilities gain the skills they need to later transition to the competitive, typically compensated workforce. The U.S. Government Accountability Office found in a recent investigation that only 5% of employees who work in sheltered workshops transition to a job in the community, receiving a minimum wage or higher compensation. But this bill is not about destabilizing someone's loved one or taking punitive measures towards sheltered workshops. This bill is about a conversation. A conversation about not where we have been, but where we are going to go together to ensure that we continue to build towards a future in which people with disabilities are fully integrated and respected within all areas of our society, especially the competitive workforce. We have modeled this bill before you of approaches other states have taken to increase access to integrated, competitive, and fairly compensated employment for people with disabilities. And there are two foci that we have maintained in creating our bill, or in crafting our bill. And I'll ask Mr. McCourt to please join me at the table if he's available now. I want to say really quick that Mr. McCourt and I have been working on this bill for quite some time, and that this effort has been entirely led by and for the folks most affected by subminimum wage and by disenfranchisement in our society as a result of living with a disability. The two foci that we maintain in crafting this bill are that all people who are able and willing to work deserve a living wage, and the opportunity to live and work in a fully integrated setting should be guaranteed to all. It has been said that disability is both a cause and a consequence of poverty. People with disabilities are more likely to experience hunger, housing instability, poverty, and adverse health outcomes as a result of limited access to health care than people who do not have a disability. many of whom have been paid a subminimum wage at one point or another in their lives, and I have worked hand in hand to put together this bill in a manner that is led by and focused on by the people who are most affected by limited competitive workforce opportunities. The second focus, an equal focus of ours that we have kept in our mind, is that should the subminimum wage be phased out, there are completely valid concerns that people with disabilities who would otherwise be unable to participate in an integrated work setting without a subminimum wage would lose a vital and important mechanism through which they are able to integrate into the broader community. I know that there are some very compassionate families here to testify today because they do not want their loved ones to lose their chance to work and to live their lives in an integrated and fulfilling community setting. I want to start by thanking all of you for coming to testify today. Your voice is crucial for us to craft appropriate legislative solutions to secure a good quality of life for folks with disabilities, and I want you to know that I cherish your feedback. In consideration of these concerns, I have a testifier from the Autism Society who will describe the community integration alternatives to subminimum wage compensation, as well as how we as a state can move forward in ensuring that everybody who lives with a disability is able to have access to the full breadth of opportunity and stability as folks without disabilities. So in conclusion, Madam Chair, before I turn over to my testifier, in all aspects of our society, especially when considering how we have heretofore left behind people with disabilities, we must, as time progresses, evaluate how we can expand on the advancements towards equity in the past to ensure we live in a future in which all people are treated with dignity in the eyes of the law. The Declaration of Independence states that we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all people are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And that is what we hope to achieve in part through this legislation. And with that, Madam Chair, I will turn it over to my testifier, Mr. McCourt.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. McCourt. Please state your name for the record and continue with your testimony.
Noah McCourt. Madam Chairwoman, my name is Noah McCourt, and I'm one of the co-chair people of the 4 Cents an Hour Coalition, which is an 100% disability-led coalition committed to the phase-out of the subminimum wage and the fair and equitable employment opportunities for Minnesotans with disabilities. While I appreciate the accolades from Representative Cantrell, this conversation did not start with me. It really started several years ago with the National Council on Disability and a variety of advocacy organizations calling for the end of the subminimum wage and for a moratorium to be placed on the issuance of any new 14C certificates and to strengthen the overall enforcement of that program. Some people will testify before this body today about the importance of maintaining the choice or the option to work for subminimum wages. The belief that someone would choose to make less money for the work is in and of itself a demonstration of how certificate holders do not believe that people with disabilities are whole people capable of making even the most basic decisions beneficial to themselves. And yet, as you examine this issue, I urge you to not lose sight of the ultimate goals that is the advancement of the civil rights for Minnesotans with disabilities. The ADA became the law of the land in 1990, and its goal was to ensure equality of opportunity for participation, independent living, and economic self-sufficiency. Each of these national policy goals is compromised or impossible as long as paying people with disabilities subminimum wage persists.
Oops.
It is also helpful to remember 14C's age. It became legal to pay people with disabilities below the minimum wage in 1938, when there were no federally protected civil rights for anyone, let alone people with disabilities. Anything done for people with disabilities in the 1930s, like affording them the opportunity to earn pennies an hour, was charity because of the lack of belief in people with disabilities at the time and the continued disbelief in people with disabilities. However, since the 1930s, society and people with disabilities have come to expect far more out of their lives than past public policies allowed. Today, we have different words for the opportunity to work for pennies an hour, words like discrimination and exploitation. I could go into the legal protections here, and I have them written in my testimony, but for the sake of time, I'd rather note that the legal protections really don't exist. To understand where federal protections are lacking, it's important to briefly unpack the doublespeak in the narrative of many of the providers whom you hear from today. On one hand, these organizations will make regular references to people with disabilities that serve as workers and employees. They will say that their employees love the work they're doing, that there's dignity in these jobs, and that these individuals are doing and the paychecks they're earning, however meager. And to be clear, whether performing tasks like bagging screws or untangling hangers, there is financial benefit to these organizations in the work these individuals are providing. In many instances, these individuals are performing tasks that fulfill contracts outside businesses, so yes, it is work, and yes, someone is gaining benefit from that work, but sadly, it's ultimately not the person with the disability. On the other hand, in spite of the prolific employment terminology and the financial benefit, in many contexts, they say that these are simply job training, not jobs. For instance, in response to questions from Sheltered Workshops to the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, OSHA, regarding record-keeping requirements at the federal level, OSHA stated that Sheltered Workshops are an exempt industry as job training and vocational rehabilitation providers, and thus they do not need to keep OSHA injury and illness records. As someone who has in the past worked in Sheltered Workshops, I'm aware that some are very clean and well-lit, and others are dirty and poorly ventilated, and it should concern everyone that there's no requirement to report injuries and illnesses that may occur in Sheltered Workshops. You really can't have it both ways. Either it's work or it's training. And if it is work, it's clearly discriminatory. If it's training, then it's probably the most abysmal excuse and failure in job training history. With many of the people with disabilities training for 20, 30, even 40 more years without really any meaningful connection to the community or really any forward momentum on their future. In 2017, the U.S. Department of Labor investigated 217 workshops. 90% of them were found to have violated 14C requirements, resulting in nearly $2.5 million in back wages going back to over 7,000 employees. In 2018, they investigated 201 cases, and 83% of them were found to be in violation, resulting in $2.6 million in back wages, impacting over 9,000 employees. The percentage of violations and the amount of back wages reclaimed would be totally unacceptable in any other business. It is said that we collect data on things that we view as important, and historically, we just don't count people with disabilities. For this reason, it's not surprising that there's an extreme lack of data available on people with disabilities who are paid sub-minimum wage. For far too long, the facts about 14C have really been hidden from the public, and policymakers leave the truth about 14C to be designed by lobbyists for the providers who have the most to gain out of it. When advocacy organizations and various entities call for a phase out of 14C, in early 2012, no state or local government had eliminated the payment of subminimum wages through legislation. However, 7 years later, we've seen many, many exciting developments. Maryland, Alaska, New Hampshire, Texas, and yes, I say Texas, and the cities of Seattle, Washington, and Reno, Nevada, have all passed legislation banning the payment of subminimum wage. And there is pending legislation in Connecticut, Illinois, Montana, New York, and over 20 other states to do the same thing. For far too long, 14C certificate holders have used the scare tactic that if 14C is eliminated, people will lose their jobs. But in reality, what they're really saying is that they, the workshop owner, will be the ones firing the very people they claim to care so much about, because they refuse to pay people with disabilities minimum wages and accept that the reality of the ADA by working to transition people to jobs in the community. And if the current business model can't deal with the increase in wages, then we need to talk about changing their business model. It can, and it has been done across the country. The U.S. Department of Labor and the Journal on Vocational Rehabilitation publish studies all the time on providers that change their business model and move on and are successful. You know, we've seen this in Minnesota with organizations like LifeWorks and Allied People Solutions who have simply phased out their subminimum wage. And they've moved on. The sky has not fallen and nobody has died. So in conclusion, we know this is going to require resources and the collective muscle of everyone who cares about equality for all Americans. And with the 30th anniversary of the ADA just a few months away, I feel that this conversation is particularly timely. As long as it remains legal to pay people with disabilities less than minimum wage, little pressure exists to invest in alternate models. If paying our fellow Americans with disabilities pennies an hour under the pretense of training continues, our national policy goals, despite the passage of civil rights laws, despite the advancements of education for people with disabilities, and despite our national marches towards equality for all human beings, will remain nothing more than hollow words. Thank you for your opportunity to testify before you today, and I urge you to pass this House file. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McCourt. Next on the agenda...
Madam Chair, I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Representative Cantrell.
Representative Freiberg is here also to share a little bit. He's my chief co-author on this bill, and he has a personal connection to what we're talking about today. So if you would mind indulging us, Madam
sure.
Chair.
Just a reminder that we do have another bill on the agenda, and we had some testifiers come down from Duluth, so we want to try and keep testimony short to this as short as possible. So with that, Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I will keep this really short, if only because I have a committee that I'm supposed to be in right now. So I apologize for being late. Representative Cantrell did ask me to co-present the bill with him. I'll just keep my remarks very short and then head off to my committee, but I appreciate this opportunity. And I appreciate Representative Cantrell for his leadership on this issue, and as well as Mr. McCourt. Appreciated hearing his testimony just then, too. I'm glad I got the opportunity. So I'm an autism parent. One of my children has been diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder. So when Representative Cantrell approached me about this bill, I thought it was a really important issue. Basically, just as a parent, I want my child's work to be valued as much as mine is and everyone else is in Minnesota. Minnesotans have a minimum wage, and I think employees with disabilities should be treated the same as other Minnesotans and afforded the same rights, including the right to a reasonable minimum wage. I think this bill goes about it in a very sensible, cautious manner by phasing it in, creating a task force to look at the issue. So I'm just happy to be on this bill and glad to have the opportunity to speak in favor of it. And that's really all I wanted to say.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Next, we have Alex Jaffe. And then after that, Chris June, if you want to make your way up as well.
Okay.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Okay. My name is Alex Jaffe, and should I state today's date then? Or?
No, just
go ahead. Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Alex Jaffe. I have a bachelor's degree in criminal justice. I'm a stand-up comedian. I have Asperger's syndrome as well as ADD. And when I lived in adult foster care, I was forced to work at ProAct Incorporated for subminimum wage. Sheltered workshops are an industry that are built on the blood and sweat of a vulnerable population, people with disabilities. And it's a clear case of exploitation. And let's face it, it's a wage gap issue. Passing the proposed legislation will eliminate subminimum wage. It will help the disabled community make a stand against workplace discrimination as well as equal protection under the law. The extra money will help the members of the disabled community afford their own piece of the American dream, and most importantly, it will provide dignity to the community. If an industry can't survive when it's required to pay its employees minimum wage, it should not be in business. And this is not about a handout. This is about a hand up. It is not about standing with an industry that is built on exploitation. It is about standing with the people who are exploited. The disabled community is notoriously not given a voice. I remember being in special ed and being told to sit down and shut up whenever I brought up a concern, and being told that the people in charge knew what was best for me and that I should listen to them. In short, in closing, my name is Alex Jaffe, and I hope you support this legislation.
Thank you. Mr. June, if you'd like to state your name for the record and continue.
My name is Chris June. I want to thank everybody for giving me the time to speak. So I do freelance photojournalism, as well as I'm starting my own disability-focused news outlet. And when I was about 10, I was diagnosed with autism, pervasive developmental disorder. The way I was treated, I saw completely change. Going from a regular school setting to special ed, you start to realize that you get discriminated against on a daily basis. Special ed, in many ways, is segregation. No. After I graduated high school, I went to a transition program, and the people I grew up that I saw my entire life, like Alex Jaffe, they were put into sheltered workshops. So, to give you an idea, imagine you went through special ed your entire life. Every day you were segregated onto a shorter bus, different from your friends down the street. All your classes were in a hidden corner of the school, away from mainstream classes. The treatment you received daily was discriminatory. When you reached adulthood, you were told that you don't deserve to make the same pay as everybody else. Sometimes that pay is less than 1/200th of what every normal person makes. You get told that you're lucky to work at all, or that people like you should be happy to have these opportunities, or that this company is doing you a favor by paying you anything so you can experience a regular job. Those excuses for discrimination against us take away our humanity and our dignity. Those excuses are what people use to justify discrimination against us based on the fact that we have a disability. At this point in your life, do you have any hope? At this point, do you have any hope, any dreams or goals, or you just give up on everything and submit? What this bill for equal pay would do is give so many people hope. It would mean that if you work hard, put your blood, sweat, and tears into something, and if you enter the arena, then maybe you will have a chance to have the life you want. Maybe you won't ever get there, but to have the chance and ability to hope and to dream and to strive towards a goal, it's important, and it's a powerful thing. I believe life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And to be able to pursue happiness, you need to be able to achieve it. And currently, with subminimum wage, that cannot be done for so many people in the state and so many people in this country. We as a people are sick of being discriminated against. We deserve the same rights and liberties as everyone else. We deserve the ability to work hard for the things we want in life and the chance to flourish through our hard work. Subminimum wage is discrimination, and until we get rid of it, equality will not exist for any of the 20% of Americans in this country that has a disability. Thank you.
Thank you. Next up, we have Don and Laura, and I'm sorry if I butchered this, but Kovanovich? All right. Hey, I'll track that up to a win then.
I don't know what you mean, Mr.
Hinge. Welcome to the committee, and if you would just state your name for the record and continue with your testimony.
Hello. My name is Laura Kovacovich. I live at the Pinefield Group Home and work at the Barely Used Tibbs Store in Hubbard County Developmental Achievement Center in Park Rapids. I am 28 years old and was born 3 months prematurely with many special needs and disabilities. In addition to autism and obsessive compulsive disorder, I also have vision and hearing disabilities. I was born with cataracts and my right eye is blind because I have glaucoma. Park Rapids is a small town and there are not a lot of jobs available. I am not able to do most of the jobs in the competitive community anyway because of my vision problems and also because of my anxiety, which is more difficult to control in a noisy or overstimulating places. When we visited other workplaces, they told us I needed to land the jobs that they have available. At the DIC, they create and provide jobs that fit my individual skills, interests, and capabilities. All of my coworkers in Park Rapids also have special needs and disabilities, just like I do. Many of them have become my friends, like Luann Tater and Joyce Kettler. We have lunch together and we do activities after work with our Heartland Homes helpers. I feel like this has become the community where I am the most happy and feel the most comfortable. There were no openings in Heartland Homes, so I waited 7 years so I could live there with some of my coworkers. My family lives in rural northern Hubbard County in Bemidji, so my dad needed to drive 50 miles twice a day to meet the DAC bus in Lake George so I wouldn't be isolated at home all day. I will never be able to drive a car because of my vision problems and my anxiety and my other disabilities. So, like many other people, I really depend on the transportation that is part of our DAC program. I love riding the DAC bus to work every day and the funny bus drivers who play different radio stations every day. I really love my jobs at the DAC and at the Barely Used Thrift Store. At the thrift store, I price and shelf donated items and sort and recycle used clothes. I price items using a pricing gun and sort the items I call unsellable items. Wah-wahs. Sometimes I can even do my own personal shopping and buy items with my own money. My favorite job supervisor there is Nancy. Nancy gives me lots of items to price, teaches me how to do all my jobs, and helps to make things run smoothly for me and my coworkers. She also helps me if I become upset or anxious or have any other problems at work. Because I have OCD and autism, I become anxious or upset very easily if things don't work right away, if there are unexpected changes, or if people accidentally get into my workspace. I don't always know how to appropriately handle social situations. Sometimes I even throw temper tantrums and lose my temper and lose control of my hands and my body. I obsess about dead things and repeat phrases from cartoons over and over and over and over. Nancy has a lot of training and experience, so she understands her workers and helps us work together successfully. I also work part of the day at the Park Rapids. I also work at the Hubbard County DAC in Park Rapids. At the DAC, I do a variety of jobs, such as filing office papers, cutting price tags for the thrift store, shredding used papers, and gluing and rolling strips of fabrics into spiffy balls that other employees weave into beautiful rugs and weaving looms. We sell our rugs at local gift shops. Everyone keeps busy at work. My favorite job supervisors at the DAC are Linda Kay because she lets me file files and she helps me if I become anxious or upset. She reminds me not to let the unthinkables take over my brain and to use super flexible thinking. I also like Richard because he taught me how to make spiffy balls and how to do other jobs that I like. Another thing I like to do at the DAC are my exercises with my physical therapist. I exercise on the exercise equipment 3 days a week and stretch and lift weights twice a week. A healthy worker is a happy worker. Our motto is reduce, reuse, recycle. One person's trash is another person's treasure. I really help our community and our planet when I do my jobs at the DAC and the barely used thrift store. I am so happy that I get to go to work every day. I would be very bored at home if I couldn't go to work like my brother and sister did. I tell people that the world would be a better place if everyone loved their work as much as I do. I don't think I could work at a job that did not have special helpers and job supervisors. I needed a one-on-one helper called a paraprofessional in order to go to school when I was younger. Because of my high anxiety and my other disabilities, I never know for sure when the unthinkable will come take over my brain. I also need to work somewhere that does not have too much pressure and be flexible enough to accommodate my special needs. If I'm not in a safe place, workplace, some people might bully me because of my disabilities. Job supervisors who don't understand autism would not know what to do when I am upset. I really like my coworkers too. We all have so much in common and I feel very comfortable with them. When I was at school with people who were not handicapped, I didn't have any friends. I think friends are very important. At the DAC, they let us play games together during our break times at work and give us choices to sign up for social and creative activities instead of working if we would prefer to do that. Usually I prefer to keep busy and work, though. Working is my favorite choice. Just like everyone else, I should have the right to choose where I live and work. Oh, work, work. I should also have the right to choose who I live with and work with. I don't want to be the only person with disabilities in my workplace. It is hard to be the minority. If you vote to eliminate special wages and wages, then my workplace will need to shut down and I will no longer have the choice to work and I will be separated from all my friends. Some people think I need more money, but I really don't. My food and living expenses are already covered because there are programs to support people who have severe disabilities. I just need a little bit of money to buy new books and new DVDs and new art supplies sometimes. The people who help me at my job and in my group home are the ones who need more money. I am so happy I get to go to my job every day, and I would be very sad if I could no longer work there. I always tell my family that I want to work until I'm 70 years old and live in my group home until I'm 80 years old. I know I am very, very lucky, and I hope I can stay here forever. So please don't take away any of my choices. Handicapped people like me should have the right to choose where they work and who, where they live and who they live with and where they work with. So don't take away any of my choices.
Thank you for your testimony.
Good afternoon. My name is Dawn Kovacovich, and I'm a retired educator from Northern Hubbard County near Bemidji, Minnesota. My husband, Michael, and I are parents of three grown children, including Laura Kovacovich, whom you've just met. Ladies and gentlemen of the House, thank you so much for your service to our communities and for the state of Minnesota. And I also want to thank you for allowing us the opportunity to speak with you today on this important issue. I'm going to focus on two major considerations with regard to this bill. The first is choice, and the second is regarding integration. When I look around this room, I see a lot of compassionate people who wish to serve their constituents in the most fair and equitable way possible. You wouldn't be considering this bill at all if you felt that somebody's rights and economic justice weren't being compromised. As a former special education teacher, I'm very familiar with the least restrictive environment laws and the overall goal of integrating people with special needs into the mainstream as much as possible. In fact, I made sure, because I'm aware of the laws, I made sure that Laura was able to have a one-on-one para, which is very costly to school districts, by the way, so that she could attend school in a fully integrated setting since her memory is very intact. You can see she's educated. She wrote the speech, and she is very articulate in reading and speaking. And I wanted her to reach her full potential at that because we didn't know what that was at that time. Now that she's an adult, our family has found it necessary to come to realistic terms regarding Laura's current abilities and also her future. She is definitely a vulnerable adult. She needs a fully supported living and working environment, both for her own safety and for the safety of others around her. She's not kidding when she says she loses control of her body and she has temper tantrums.
That's, and I lose my temper.
Yep, that's a reality for a lot of our disabled people. We live in a very competitive, capitalistic society where disruptive behavior, high anxiety, and low productivity are generally not tolerated in the workplace. A baseline capability is necessary for any entry-level job in the competitive community. For those who do not have that baseline capability, the special wage provisions in 14C allows them to work in a supported setting at their own pace to the best of their ability. The compensation that they receive is based on average productivity for that particular job. Laura has made it very clear that she loves to work and would be devastated, and she would. She would be devastated if this choice was taken from her. It's actually rather flawed logic that removal of this choice is going to somehow increase her capability so that she could work in a competitive setting. That's just not reality. The employment model at the Hubbard County Developmental Achievement Center is person-centered. The people who are capable and interested in working in competitive mainstream work where people without disabilities are in the majority are already doing so. Those that, like Laura, who need a lot more support, prefer to work in the supported setting that's provided, regardless of what their wage is. One of the key misconceptions that many people have is a belief that working in a supported work center is a mandate. It is not a mandate. It is a choice. Nobody forces them to go to work in a supported work setting. Laura and others with similar disabilities do not need an income to provide for their daily living expenses. She is qualified for the developmental disability waiver that pays for this. There's other programs in place to help support the living expenses of people who qualify for these programs. The checks she receives from the DAC are regarded as spending money, and they help build her self-esteem as a contributing member of society. The dignity that she gains from having jobs she loves, and yes, some people really love repetitive work. It's the way their brains are wired. We're all different. And for some people, if you walked into a DAC setting and saw them enjoying the repetitive tasks that they do, may not be something that makes me excited, but it does to some other people. It's more valuable to them to do those jobs than the monetary reward. For us as parents and guardians, we appreciate that she has a comprehensive full-day routine in a safe, developmentally appropriate setting. There's a lot of states who have abolished supported work settings. A lot of their children are going to work an hour a day at a grocery store, and then they have nothing to do the rest of the day. I mean, I wish there was more data on this to share with you, but at this time, it's just currently being gathered. She very likely receives more in services from transportation to staff support than she actually produces. When we factor wages for a typical job, support services are generally not part of that package. So just to be clear, without 14C provisions for subminimum wages, supported work centers like the Hubbard County DAC would not be able to remain in operation. Earlier, somebody said that they should be forced to do this. If they are, you know, the reality is we've got some people that may work for like 10 minutes and then take a 2-hour nap work 10 more minutes. There's people that work at a productivity level that's vastly different than yours or mine. We have to account for those differences. These workplaces cannot finance minimum wage when you have such a variability of capability and productivity. It's just not possible. Laura's workplace and the quality of life would end for her if these facilities were shut down, and they will shut down if they are forced to pay minimum wage. That's just reality. The jobs of her coworkers and support staff would be lost. Earlier this morning, I read that Minnesota has the most supported work settings. They call them sheltered workshops as kind of a derogatory way of positioning this, that they lead the way. I'm proud of that. That shows that Minnesota is one of the leaders in providing supported work settings for people like my daughter. This is something that we should applaud, not put down. Working for less than minimum wage is a choice, and if we take away that choice without first providing an alternative, we're destroying the quality of life for thousands of people. Are we prepared at this time to relocate all these people into meaningful, developmentally appropriate work with the necessary support systems they require, especially in rural areas like Park Rapids, where there's few jobs to begin with? My second point, and I'll be brief with this, is regard to the concept of integration. I'm guessing that many of you have parents or grandparents or loved ones who are currently living in some type of assisted living center or a nursing home. In the past, the only choice for aging parents was to live in the home of another family member. Now we have other acceptable choices for this population. When my sister-in-law and her husband bought a condo at a 55-plus living center, we regarded that as a choice. When developmentally disabled people live or work together, we call it segregation. Before we create sweeping legislation that forces people with disabilities to always be the minority in a population, I think it's important to ask them what they prefer. If you have ever been in a situation where you were the only person of a certain race or gender in a room, you know how this feels. When Laura was fully integrated into the mainstream of socially savvy teenagers at her high school, she was a quiet, subdued little person, the only person in the room with autism and visual disabilities. At the DAC, her big, outgoing personality literally fills up the room. She's a confident person, popular with her peers. She has real friends for the first time in her life. She even has a young man who's interested in her. When it comes to integration, that too should remain a choice for the developmentally disabled and their families. It's not a choice for everybody. Not everybody wants to work in a supported work center. But as I said before, this is a choice. Anything less than continuing to offer that choice is discriminatory. I urge you to recognize that people with disabilities differ in their abilities. They differ in their abilities. They differ in their interests and their desires as much as the general population. When we remove choices that allow for dignity, quality of life, and for living and working among like-minded peers, we are compromising freedom. The provision of 14C does not take away anyone's right to seek employment in the competitive workforce. I'll say that again. The provision of 14C does not take away anyone's right to seek employment in the competitive workplace. Elimination of 14C will destroy all options for those who cannot work at a competitive level. It will destroy all options for people who cannot do this. Please don't take away this option. Instead, I invite you to look at the Hubbard County DAC program as an outstanding model of person-centered employment and opportunity. There's always room for improvement in many types of programs, and we need to work at providing quality options in every community, not just Park Rapids, especially in rural areas where employment opportunities are limited. Our HDAC director, Laura Johnson, would be happy to fill you in on the specifics of our program up there. Laura and I, this Laura, would be happy to answer any further questions you have and share our testimony with you. I sure thank you for your time and your consideration. I have also printed out some 10 talking points that I can hand out to you before I leave today.
Thank you so much, and thank you for coming down to testify.
Thank you.
We really appreciate it. Next up, and just a reminder, please, if we can keep the testimony short, we do have a couple other testifiers on another bill that drove a long way, too. So next up, we have Jillian Nelson.
Good afternoon, Council members. I'm Jillian Nelson. I'm the Community Resource and Policy Advocate for the Autism Society of Minnesota. I am also a member of the Governor's Council on Developmental Disabilities, as well as the State Rehabilitation Council, which oversees VRS and DEED. Also, prior to my current role, I was an employment consultant for adults with disabilities, and I am also an autistic adult myself. I'm here to ask you to support House File 3433. I am not going to skirt around the issue. The elimination of sub-minimum wage is inevitable. The call for this change as a matter of human rights is sweeping our nation like a wave. The question is, will Minnesota be prepared? House File 3433 will give our state the preparation to prepare for this drastic shift in employment culture. Let me be clear, based on the testimony we heard, this bill and this plan to prepare for the elimination of subminimum wage, this is about disaster preparedness. If we do not plan, if we do not coordinate, Laura's mother is absolutely right. Thousands of individuals will be left without work, will be left without community engagement, without meaningful connection to their community. But this bill means that Minnesota can plan to be able to sustain programs like Laura's, without compromising human rights. We do not have to choose between supported employment and human rights. We can support people and allow them to earn a minimum wage. Throughout the country, subminimum wage is being removed at a rapid rate. However, it is not always being done with appropriate planning. And this is devastating individuals and families that support them for lack of programs and supports, leading to fears just like we heard. That is what sets this bill apart from what is happening in the rest of the country. That is why it is necessary for us to support this bill. As we eliminate subminimum wage, the opposition will try to tell you that there is nowhere else for their loved one to go, despite these sheltered workshops. I'm here to tell you that that is false. I've stood at the front desk of a sheltered workshop asking to get in to see my client who has asked to leave that program and seek competitive employment and been refused contact. The disability community, driven by people with disabilities, is shifting to community-based employment, both competitively and customized. This move should be common sense. We're going to do an experiment here. Raise your hand if you would want someone to tell you what your job is without any input from you. No one. If we would not accept this employment arrangement for ourselves, then who are we to allow this type of arrangement to be the norm for people with disabilities? Community-based employment allows an individual to choose where they want to work, to engage their passions, their interests, to do work that is meaningful to them. To serve this unique community, we have to look at those types of employment in the community. Competitive employment may not be an option for everyone. And that's the idea of being hired for the same job as a non-disabled employee and doing that job with or without supports. But customized employment, which is the process of looking at a business's needs and the employee's abilities and finding a place where they meet. Oftentimes, customized employment can increase business productivity by removing a task or tasks from one job description and allowing someone to focus on those things independently and individually, which frees up the capacity for the original person to do specialized tasks in their role that would not have been as easily delegated. This is the future of employment. It will happen with or without the passing of this bill. But what this bill will allow for is for us to transition to this change in employment services in a way that will allow the most dignity and respect for people with disabilities and cost Minnesota the least financially. Because I promise you, individuals without jobs will require more supports in daily community living. I thank you for your time and your attention and to this urgent need and for supporting House File, this House File.
Thank you very much. And next up is Trista, and I'm not even going to attempt because I would totally disappoint my Italian in-laws.
That's okay. Hi, I am Ramsey County Commissioner Trista Mattis-Castillo. Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. I am here today in support of House File 3433, both as a county commissioner, but also as a mother of a disabled child. I have an adult son who is severely developmentally disabled and nonverbal, and so coming from both places. I want to talk numbers because as county commissioners, we talk numbers. In Minnesota, it currently ranks number one in the country for this use of some minimum wage, even though only 13% of individuals live or work in the community. So again, it's one of those lists we don't want to be on as Minnesotans. Unfortunately, we find ourselves on those lists far too often. As we heard about the wages and people wanting to work and live in the community on their own where they're able, and when they don't make a living that's at least minimum wage, the difference comes from the counties. We are footing that bill. Money isn't magic, as you all know. You appropriate money. The money is all coming from somewhere. We are asking for employers to step up and pay for the work that is being done. We don't devalue human beings in Minnesota. We don't need to have a subminimum wage because we don't have subhumans. I am supporting this as a demonstration of our values as Minnesotans, and that we are moving into the 21st century where we value all people despite their abilities. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And nice job not skipping a beat with the lights here. Next up is Ed Reynoso.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Edward Reynoso. I'm the political director for Teamsters Joint Council 32. We represent an excess of 62,000 active and retired members in the state of Minnesota, and we are solidly in support of House File 3433. You know, many of you may ask, you know, what is a labor union getting involved with this? The reality is when it comes to workers being taken advantage of and being exploited, we're right there. We're willing to stand up and use our voice to make sure that workers have a voice and workers are treated fairly. The fact is that, you know, when we're talking about exploited workers, people will think we're talking about a third world country here. We're not. We're talking about Minnesota. And the fact that workers are able to be exploited, and when I hear somebody say that an employer, unless they're able to continue exploiting workers, is going to go out of business, so it be. The fact is that we need to stand up for our ADA community, not only in with this bill, but many other facets that are just lacking, and this community continues to be passed over. And the ADA was passed in 1990, yet we continue to have issues in compliance. So this is just the beginning, and for those that think that we're looking to stop these jobs from happening, what we're looking to do is get a fair wage, fair benefits, fair everything for any worker in this state. But the reality is that we can do this. And we're not looking to just slam this down somebody's throat. I want you, you know, take an opportunity to really read the bill. It gives a voice to every stakeholder. It gives a voice to the ADA community. It gives a voice to the employers. I don't want Laura to lose her job. I see how important it is to her. And I don't want her mom having to fathom the fact that Laura can't go to work anymore. But what we do believe is that there should be input and there should be a task force put together that provides that input for every stakeholder to make a wise decision, not only for workers, but for the ADA community. So that's why we are willing to stand up and yell to the top of the mountain, we're here with this ADA community and any worker that's ever taken advantage of and exploited.
Thank you so much. Next up is Leah Williams and Jermaine Williams. And I'd like to, we do have another bill, and we want to leave some time for member questions. So if we can, and then Jim Clapper will be next. And please try and keep testimony as brief as possible. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
If you'd like to state your name and continue with your testimony.
This is Jermaine, and I'm Leah Williams.
And this is my brother. And should we talk a little about your job?
Yeah. Jermaine loves people. He values people. He loves spending time with people, giving hugs, high fives. Is that what you're good at?
Yeah,
he is. And Jermaine's life is greatly improved by having the opportunity to work in the community. We value that as his family, my mom, my brothers, and I. You know, we highly value that opportunity for Jermaine.
Can we talk about your job?
So Jermaine works Monday through Friday at the Northfield Senior Center and a couple other places in the morning. And he works about 30 hours a week. Jermaine, do you do dusting? And you wipe the windowsills? Yeah. You see a lot of people? You talk to a lot of people? He does. He likes working. Do you enjoy working? Most days. But we all say that, I think. Some people might say that Jermaine might not do a lot of work, but for Jermaine, it's meaningful. He finds value in that, and it's important to him. He does work with a job coach and a couple other peers that together get the job done that the business has been hired for, and the business then finds value in what Jermaine does. Jermaine does make the special minimum wage, and with that, though, he's had the opportunity to be able to have this 30-hour-a-week job, which he might not have if that was eliminated. And we are all for competitive employment, absolutely. But we're also for Jermaine to be able to have a choice, do things that he values, and be in the community, which he is, every day. And that's really important to myself, my mother, who are his guardians as well. We want him to be happy. We love him more than any. And we just want him to be valued, to be a productive member of society, to have choice, and to do what he loves. And he loves being with people and talking with people and seeing people. And that's all we want for Jermaine, is to be able to have that choice and it to not be taken away. And maybe one day he'll choose competitive employment, and we're for that too. So we just want everyone to have the choice to be able to do what they want to do.
Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you
up.
So much. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Thank you.
And yes. Next up, Mr. Clapper.
Well, you make your way. Thank you.
Jermaine, nice to meet you.
Say hi.
Nice to meet you.
Welcome to the committee, and if you could state your name for the record.
My name is Jim Clapper. Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Jim Clapper. I'm a parent of a young man with intellectual and developmental disabilities who receives MA waivered support for residential and employment services. My son Bob has been happily employed since 2008 in a number of positions, all made possible under the provisions of the 14C of the Fair Labor and Standards Act. He started his employment in a center-based employment program doing light assembly and packaging work in a day training and rehabilitation program near our home. His wages at that time were about $2.35 an hour, which were commensurate with his level of productivity at that time. This is about 35% of what minimum wage was at that time. Today he works on a mobile work crew in the community at Kowalski's, and earns about $7.59 an hour, which is about 77% of the current minimum wage, and again, commensurate with his level of productivity. He has doubled his productivity in that time and moved from a center-based employment to a community-based employment setting. We're very proud of his progress. Bob is very proud of himself, too, although he does not really have a firm grasp of money. His income helps support his food and living expenses, but also does reduce his support costs with respect to MSA Shelter Needy in Minnesota and also Social Security. The 14C provisions the 14 provisions provided Bob with choices and opportunities to start his employment and then steadily develop his skills and work ethic over the last 12 years. If the elements of HF 3433 had been in place in 2008, he would have had only life enrichment activities in a DTH program. In addition, customers that contract out this work would have certainly moved away from disability employment programs in order to compete. That's the reality. Bob's story represents several thousand individuals
in Minnesota with intellectual and developmental disabilities who are thriving under the provisions of 14C and will lose their employment if HF 3433 does pass. On behalf of my son, Bob, I ask you to reject HF 3433. Not only will this bill reduce employment opportunities, it will establish another expensive and bureaucratic process which will be redundant with what already exists. I implore you to avoid fixing something that is not broken. Commensurate wages using 14C work. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I'd like to move to member discussion. Are there any members that have any questions? Representative Fabian?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Cantrell, there seems to me to be, there's a dichotomy in the testimony today. So what provisions do you see you're going to have if these center-based facilities close? When I drive home, I get to Park Rapids and I go, only three more hours to go. There's not a lot of opportunities for employment for many of the people that we're talking about. I've seen what's happened in my part of the state when even in some of the community-based opportunities that used to exist when, I'll say, more rigorous enforcement of the Olmstead Act was put in place. And I know that there were people as a result of that that are no longer working where they really enjoyed working. So how do you give comfort to the testifiers that we have here today, to Laura and Bob, and I'm sorry I've forgotten your other name. How do you give comfort to them and what we're doing here is the right thing to do?
Representative Cantrell.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Fabian, for your extremely thoughtful question. I'm going to turn to Mr. McCourt to elaborate kind of in depth on how we intend to, in a very thoughtful manner, ensure that the ability to still integrate into the community, to have the full breadth of options for people to live full lives will not be deprived as a result of this bill. So I'll turn to Mr. McCourt, if that's right with you.
Mr. McCourt?
Yes, Madam Chair. So, you know, if you notice the part of, and Representative Fabian, if you notice the part of your question, you know, your question was really framed on if the center-based employment programs close. And I think that really, the question needs to be reframed because to when they are going to close, because and when the 14C certificates are going to go away. If you look at the trends in national policy, the 14C, regardless of what the committee does here today, is going to go away, as the Autism Society and other members of the coalition have stated today. It's simply not sustainable, and it's going away. And so really what this bill does is it gives Minnesota a plan so people like those who have testified today can really have a say in how this moves forward. So nobody is going to lose their job today. And the goal with the interagency task force is to talk about how can we accommodate people in the workplace and how can that continue when the feds do phase it out, or if it happens via litigation, because there are states that the Department of Justice has sued for over-reliance on 14C certificates, because it is a violation of the ADA, and it is a matter of compliance.
Thank you. Representative Fabian? Neither. Representative Lippert?
Oh,
did you have a follow-up?
Well, so, Representative Cantrell, and I appreciate that, you know, you're the chief author of the bill. Do you agree with the statement that Mr. McCourt made?
Representative Cantrell?
Madam Chair, Representative Fabian, could you elaborate on your question, please?
Well, he's saying that these community-based facilities are going to close. It's inevitable. Do you agree with that?
Representative Cantrell?
Madam Chair, Representative Fabian. I do believe that that is the trajectory. When we are looking at the amount of states over the past even 5 years that have implemented plans or outright prohibitions on subminimum wage, the number of those states is going to continue to grow. And now former Labor Secretary Acosta said in a statement, I believe last year, that that even at the time he was looking very intently at how can we move forward in phasing out the subminimum wage. I do believe that on a bipartisan basis across the state and in the respective branches of our policy making branches of our federal government, that yes, eventually these workshops will be phased out.
Representative Fabian.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not sure that I agree with that, and I've seen what's happened in my part of the state already. Hey, listen, I wish that Laura and others were being paid more. I really do. I heard her testimony and that of her mother, and they're very concerned that the subminimum wage goes away and away goes their job. And I appreciate the well-intentioned desire to make that go away. But the reality for me is that if it does go away, the subminimum wage, there's going to be more people, like some of my constituents, who are not going to be working. I mean, how do you find facilities in deep rural Minnesota? How do you find employers who have the expertise or whatever to have meaningful employment for people in the disability community? I'm not getting much comfort, and again, I appreciate what is thought about being done here, but I really, really struggle with the real impact that's going to happen in towns of 200 or 300 or 400 people that I represent. I'm troubled by it. And so when I listen to the testimony of these folks who are concerned about it, I have a great deal of empathy for them. And when they say, don't take away my choices, who am I as a state legislator in this case to take away their choices?
Thank you, Representative Fabian. I think that's the hope of the task force. Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Cantrell, I really deeply appreciate your work, your advocacy. We had a conversation yesterday about your history with work with people with disabilities, and I share your interest in justice for people with disabilities and full dignity and the fullest quality of life for people with disabilities. As I've been having more conversations with parents with disabilities in my district, leaders in the disability community in my district, I'm realizing how complex the disability community is and the needs of people in the disability community are. And what I've been hearing consistently, one parent said to me, we need a broad spectrum of solutions as we're thinking about people with disabilities. Today I was in a conversation with one of the executive directors who leads a facility for people with disabilities in my district, who said, when we're eliminating options, we're leaving people behind, or there's a concern we're leaving people behind. And I admit that though I appreciate the spirit of the bill at this point, I share some of those concerns for people with more severe disabilities, for whom organizations in my district at least use the subminimum wage as it's a helpful tool to keep people engaged in the community. So I'm just curious about, and we've both had conversations recently, I'm curious about how you would respond to some of those concerns that I'm hearing from my district.
I'd like to move to a vote pretty soon, so Representative Cantrell.
Madam Chair and Representative Lippert, I think the best person to elaborate on the concerns of our community in Minnesota of folks living with disabilities is somebody who has already gone through what it's like to not be able to achieve competitive employment, not be able to make a living wage, somebody who is living with a disability, and somebody who is here, as we have heard, advocating for what the future of customized, fully supportive employment in a fully supportive society looks like for disability. So, Madam Chair, I'm going to turn over really quick to Mr. McCourt.
Sure. Mr. McCourt, if you could just keep it very brief.
Yes, Madam Chair. So there's been a lot of talk about organizations and a lot of the organizations that work with particular populations and Pay-14C. And to respond to your question, again, this is really what the task force is aiming to accomplish, because we recognize that a lot of policy areas are very complex, but just because something is complex does not mean that nothing should be done about them. And, you know, a prime example of this is actually LifeWorks. I don't know if many in the room are familiar with LifeWorks or Allied People Solutions, but as of 2017, these organizations have shifted their business models, and they have phased out their 14C certificates. And so I actually had a chat with the Department of Human Services the other day, and I went into DHS thinking, oh, this is going to be a fight, it's going to be all uphill. And their employment division and the disability services division just kind of looked at me and like, oh, yeah, this should have happened 20 years ago. And the reality is it should have happened 20 years ago, and that there are a lot of solutions to these nuances, and that these solutions and these conversations have really been blocked by providers for a long time. So again, as Representative Cantrell asked, we're not asking to get rid of anybody's job. We're asking for a conversation about how we can move forward on this issue that we know is coming, and how Minnesota can do best to ensure that people don't get left behind. Because if this bill doesn't pass, and if we refuse to do anything about this, then people are going to get left behind.
Thank you. Last question from Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to Representative Cantrell, 111 through 113 in the bill lines, you have said that this starts a conversation, and that's what the bill does. But as I read that, and just if you could enlighten me, it sounds as if as of August 1st, 2024, that the provision would go away and the minimum wage would be in place. Could you explain that, please?
Representative Cantrell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Vogel, I couldn't hear the very end of your question.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the question is, it appears to me that on August 1st, 2024, that the minimum wage will take effect at that point. In other words, we can't keep doing what we're doing if we're an employer, that now the law has changed. Is that correct?
Representative Cantrell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Vogel, that is correct, and that is, of course, notwithstanding if the subminimum wage is removed federally by that point in time, which it appears would be is growing ever more likely.
Yes, probably.
Yeah. So,
Madam Chair,
I mean, we're getting to a point where this is about a comprehensive approach to what a fully inclusive society looks like for Minnesota. And part of that does mean having the goal to eventually phase out this wage, which, as you have heard from my testifiers today, has led to so many feeling like they are left behind.
Representative Vogel,
Madam Chair, and
one
I know
quick
what,
follow-up, yeah, and then we're going to move
to. And I realize that, and my suggestion would be that as this thing moves on, that maybe that be looked into, because if the federal law does not change by August 21st, 2024, then I'm not against necessarily a task force looking at this, but this needs – this needs some homework, I think, Madam Chair, before it goes much farther. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. All right. So I will renew my motion that House File 3433 be referred to the Committee on Government Operations. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed?
Nay.
Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members.
All right. And so Representative Sundin is not with us today. And so we are just going to be doing an informational hearing because he did have some testifiers drive down And so House File 2467, Representative Claflin, were you going to present that? Or was, I think, Representative Olson, you're in the room. Are you going to present it? All right.
Yes.
If everybody could please keep quiet, we do have to move on to the next bill. Yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So House File 2467, an informational hearing. This is actually Representative Sundin's bill. Wasn't planning to present the bill.
Sorry to put you on the spot here.
You know, I'm glad it's an informational hearing. Full disclosure, but I do know a little bit about this bill because it was maybe a year and a half ago over the interim. A meeting was called in the Northeast Minnesota that brought together a bunch of constituents, a number of them who are here today, who had a solar installer who bid out projects for them and made agreements with them to complete these projects. They made down payments on their solar installation, and most of them never really heard from or had the projects completed and are out tunes of thousands of dollars. And so they came together and asked for a legislative solution to address this concern. And so this isn't something you'll hear from other people that work in this realm. Again, wasn't planning to present the bill. But that there is a fund that's available in most cases for things like this. But because solar installers are not a part of that, that is really what the legislation is getting at. And so with that, I'll actually, my testifiers that are here from Duluth know far more about this and are willing to share their story. So we appreciate that the committee has taken the time to do this on an informational basis.
Well, good job pinch hitting. And welcome to the committee. If you could just state your name for the record and continue with your testimony.
Yes, thank you. My name is Ryan Jones Casey, and I'm a citizen of Duluth, Minnesota. And most relevant to today's hearings, almost 3 years ago in March of 2017, I hired Able Energy to design and install a 4.8 kilowatt solar array on the roof of my house. I paid them $8,800, which represented 50% of the total project cost. The company assured me that this payment would place me on their work plan for that same calendar year, which by getting the project done in 2017, I'd be able to file for the 30% federal tax rebate when I filed my 2017 taxes. And as of today, almost 3 years later, the installation hasn't started. Able Energy and its owner, Mike Harvey, have been sued by the Department of Labor and Industry, and courts have ordered him and his company to pay significant fines while also reimbursing the more than 80 Minnesota citizens who paid him a combined $1.5 million in deposits for work that in many cases has not been started and virtually all cases has not been completed. Unfortunately for Minnesota citizens, the owner of Able Energy, Mike Harvey, has filed for bankruptcy, and there's no reasonable expectation that any of these customers will ever be repaid. So as you might expect, I'm here to testify in favor of House Bill 2467, which would modify the Department of Labor and Industry's Contract Recovery Fund to include claims against solar installers. So in preparation for today's hearing, I went to the Department of Labor's and Industry's website and downloaded the Contract Recovery Fund's annual report for fiscal year 2018 because I wanted myself to have a better understanding of exactly what's going on with that fund. And reading through that annual report was an illuminating experience for me. Among other things, I learned that the fund was created by the legislature in 1994 to compensate certain owners of residential property who have suffered a direct and out-of-pocket loss due to fraudulent, deceptive, or dishonest practices, conversions of funds, or failure of performance that arose out of a contract directly between the licensee and the homeowner. Essentially exactly what has happened to these 80 citizens in Minnesota that were essentially taken advantage of by this Able Energy company. So just as a quick summary, in fiscal year 2018, 72, I learned since the inception of the fund, the revenues collected from contractors have always exceeded the claim payouts to homeowners. In fiscal year 2018, revenues exceeded payouts by about $1 million. The fund balance has steadily increased since 2012 and currently stands at $9 million. I also learned that in fiscal year 2018, 72 approved claims were filed with an average payout of about $13,400. And I apologize if you all are already well-versed in this, but for those that aren't, to apply for this contractor recovery fund compensation, homeowners have to get a court-ordered judgment, which I believe is about a $340 filing fee. In fiscal year 2018, 6,218 residential contractors paid contractor recovery fund fees when they received a new license or renewed their existing license. They have to do that every 2 years. It costs about $400 to $600 for each contractor for those 2 years, and includes such disciplines as folks that work on boilers, building officials, CE administration, contractor registration, electrical folks, elevator folks, high-pressure piping, manufacturing structures, mechanical bonds, plumbing, residential contractors, water conditioning, basically like most of the contractors that are out there. But unfortunately, when this legislation that created the fund was passed in 1994, solar installations weren't so prevalent. And so solar installers were not specifically called out as one of the contractors available for citizens to apply for compensation from. So what's clear to me, and I do acknowledge that I, of course, have an $8,800 vested interest in this opinion, is that the spirit of the Contractor Recovery Fund was certainly meant to cover situations like these 80 citizens have experienced. These solar installers, they're crawling in folks' attics, they're penetrating roofs with solar panel mounting hardware, they're prepping electrical connections, work that's not dissimilar from lots of other contractors that are covered by the fund. My last point is that, while I know some will argue that since solar installers haven't been paying into this fund, then perhaps citizens who have been fleeced by solar installers shouldn't be able to file for claims. But I find that logic faulty. The fund doesn't treat each contractor as their own separate account, distinct and separate, in which they have to like amass a certain balance before someone can file a claim. If that were the case, it would take my solar contractor 28 years worth of paying fees to cover just my one $8,800 claim. So all that to say that this fund is clearly designed so that 6,000 different contractors can pay a relatively low fee, so that when the occasional bad actor contractor takes advantage of citizens, there's some level of recourse for those citizens. So I urge you to pass House Bill 8647, which would modify the Contractor Recovery Fund to include claims against solar installers. Thank you. Thank
you. Representative Micklin, was this specifically to this testifier? We do have one more.
Go ahead and do the next.
Okay, thank you. Next up is Blake Shippey.
Good afternoon. Thank you, committee, for hearing this bill. My name is Blake Shippey. I'm also a resident of Duluth, Minnesota. I own a property management company. It's a residential property management company. We have about 1,700 units that we manage, own, operate. We decided to go into a relationship with this company, Able Energy, back in August of 2016. And we entered into four different contracts with them, totaling about $107,000 down in payments on four apartment buildings and my personal home. But I won't go over the history. Ryan did a beautiful job of laying out basically the bill and why solar industry is not being, you know, attached to this general fund. So many of the people in the state of Minnesota have been out, specifically from this company, out all the money that they have invested into their homes. But I will just give you a general history of my experience with Able Energy. We signed the contract in October of 2016, And then I was told that the work was going to be done August 2017. August 2017 came around. Almost all communication stopped with the company at that point. They hired another gentleman. His name was Dave Larson, who informed me that he was working pro bono for the owner because he knew him, and that he would communicate with me and we'll get this all resolved. Well, his communication kind of dwindled off in around September of 2017, and then basically in October, in November of 2017, all communication stopped. And then if you want to learn more about this company, I encourage you or urge you to, you know, Google Able Energy. Star Tribune and Jeff Mitrot put out four reports on this company, and you can research that yourself. But the company specifically clearly was not a very professional company, and they screwed a lot of people out of a lot of money. And it's really sad to see. And so this fund certainly will protect the future of our residents in the state of Minnesota that want to invest in solar. But our hope is that we can also, those that were affected from prior, we can retroact this bill, will allow us to reinvest our initial investment back into the solar, because right now we have not been able to move forward on any of those projects. But by allowing this bill to pass, we can certainly continue moving forward. So, thank you.
I hope members are okay with staying a little bit over four or a little bit past 4 o'clock. Luckily, we don't have a long walk to the floor. So next up, I have Judy Gibbs. Welcome to the committee. If you could just state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Hi there. My name is Judy Gibbs. And I'm also from Duluth, and thanks for your time and for your service, all of you. Appreciate it. I'm going to be really brief just because they covered it. I'm just here to ask for the support of the House Bill 2467. I'm even going to skip my story. I'm out $7,800 bucks. But when the Star Tribune reported that Blake just referenced, he published several lengthy articles about the owner and uncovered that Minnesotans have been swindled out of a collective $1.5 million. So I'm here today to ask you to include solar installers and contractors in the contractor fund to protect future Minnesotans from other swindlers.
Thank you so much. And next up we have former Representative Jeremy Kalin. Is that still your title? does it
sadly,
stick with us?
As you all know, you... Once given it, you keep it. Madam Chair and members, Jeremy Kalin, attorney at Advisen Legal in Minneapolis and former member of this body. Typically, my practice is actually building companies and mobilizing capital to advance deep sustainability through economic development projects around the state, from the far northwest Minnesota to helping grow saltwater shrimp in South Dakota and Madison, Minnesota, and nearby. But because of my experience with solar and understanding the sad situation we just heard about with Able Energy, when homeowners started coming to me with a new and much larger issue with an out-of-state contractor called AltaRay, and the fraud that was perpetrated on no fewer than 124 Minnesotans, we think the problem could be as large as 180 Minnesotans, started digging in and understanding what we could do to help get justice for these victims. So the Able Energy customer victims are out, sadly, nearly $10,000 each, as you just heard. Well, AltaRay entered the market here in Minnesota about a year ago, violated a number of both civil and criminal laws. Very likely that'll be up for prosecutors to prove on the criminal side, but in 13 states and as many as 800 to 1,200 victims, promising that they would be able to go solar with too high prices, promising that they would eliminate their electric bills, promising that they could get this federal tax credit. And what they did, and then also saying to those customers, to those victims, here is a loan application that'll pay for 100% of your project. That loan application turned out to be a loan agreement in most cases. I represent 22 clients directly, 21 of whom are in Minnesota. A couple have paid cash. Nearly all of them took out these loans and are stuck with loan payments. And what Alteré did was put up the solar on their roofs and walk away, having made no electrical connections, claiming other people's licenses. It is a total moral failure. Why is House File 2647 needed to add solar to the Contractor Recovery Fund? Because absent agreements that were made with one utility, thanks to the solar, to MNSEA, the Solar Energy Industry Association, and others, that Alteré was required to take out a residential building contractor's license. Enacting this bill will ensure that not only are the 140, 180 Minnesotans who've been victims of this $2 to $8 million fraud able to get justice, but also the retroactive component can help our able energy victims as well. It is really important to know that in order to recover from the Contractor Recovery Fund, you need a civil judgment. You need to sue and have a court find that the contractor has been wrong, has done harm, is responsible for those damages, and needs, and you deserve damages. The cap on the fund is unfortunately $300,000. Down the road, I hope we can have a conversation and come back about how to deal with these total moral failures so that perhaps the Department of Labor and Industry can bring that lawsuit and not need a co-counsel who's a trial lawyer to bring that. It's not going to be me. But right now, as the law sits, solar is treated inferior, a solar contractor and thus solar victims, to someone that you hire to hang wallpaper in your house. That's a special skill and eligible for Contractor Recovery Fund, or to paint the trim in your living room and your kitchen. It's just good to bring some justice here. It's a very simple bill that can do so, and I'm happy to stand for any questions. I know that we're needing to get you all to the floor quickly.
And I know we're not taking any formal action on this, so if there's anybody who has traveled, I would say that you could come forward. But if you haven't traveled and you plan to be here when we take formal action on this bill, I'd ask that you keep that testimony for that day. So is there anybody that traveled to come testify on this bill? Seeing none. Thank you so much any closing words on your bill, Representative Olson?
Thank you for taking this, and thank you for taking the testimony from Duluth residents that made the trek here today.
Thank you so much. Oh, Representative Mecklen, I'm sorry, you had a question.
Sorry. Yes, I do have a few. I'll try to keep it quick. Thank you, Madam Chair. With the realm of the Contract Recovery Fund, it comes with a lot of stipulations. I actually pay into this fund, and it requires us to be licensed. It requires us to prove we're insured. And this here says they may or may not have been licensed. So we kind of went through this 2 years ago with the word I'm looking for, handyman. You know, they were allowed to build a certain amount, like I think it's one house every 2 years, and not be licensed, and then a lot of good people got hurt. This is part of what we kind of push back on, saying that this is the downside of when you do not hire somebody who's licensed, where you have these securities. Question for you would be, do you think it would be prudent to make sure that all going forward, all these installers should be licensed with education and with, so that, I mean, if I think they testified the other day, some of these installers are from out of state, and there's several different roofing types here than you may find in Arizona.
Do you think that would be probably a better question for the author of the bill? Or Representative Olson?
Yeah, Madam Chair and Representative Mecklen, that is in the bill. The addressing the issue of licensure and solar installers, and I know that we have some folks that probably would be testifying in the event of more time that could speak to this as well, but we that is part of what would be in this, not just having access to the fund, but requiring the licensure and paying into the fund by the solar manufacturers.
Madam Chair, it does clearly say somewhere in here whether or not the person has been or licensed. So, and to that, we went through this before, and it became kind of a very contentious thing. I'm kind of having a hard time saying this would be like me going and buying an insurance policy, and now for something that happened 4 years ago to me. And that's where I'm having, trouble for having been in this industry for so long. And I feel really bad for all you that got hurt. Currently, Senator Howe and I are working on a couple that got bit really bad this last year. And they have a very legitimate claim. And they're going through the process now. And, it is attorney's fees, and it requires a judgment. But they hired a licensed contractor that they did their due diligence on. And that, I think, is the bigger difference here.
So I think what we will have to come back to this, and when the author is with us, he can probably answer more of these questions. This is informational, so sure. Keep all those questions in mind, and we will have plenty more time to ask more information on this bill. So with that, I will adjourn this meeting.